Are you trying to argue that Supernova is not a reflection of the late 90s? Radio Drone. On a Thursday night, I believe Josh Hadley is a product of internet culture run amok. I'm not sure. Peter, what are you an era of?
I was an era of putting out a lot of videos in 2014, and so far this year, not so much.
Slacker. Cecil, he's a throwback to the time when people didn't like good movies.
Yeah, something like that.
What you guys should do, if you do like good things, in you or you in, go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code DROME, and you would get 10 free gifts on top of whatever you order. You'd get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free Canada's Mexico shipping, which would be the United States. All for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. I want to talk about how movies, horror movies specifically, but sci-fi and other genres as well, are a product of their time. And I don't mean that in the way of like, oh, you see virtual reality in a movie, you go, oh, that is so 1991, or you see lots of neon, you go, oh, that is so the 80s. That's not what I'm talking about with product of the time. I mean, of the times of what's happening in the world, movies tend to be an answer to what is going on in the world. And that's been true of film ever since it began. Do you see that the movies, for instance, of 2014, 2015 are very much an answer to what is going on in 2014 and 2015, the same way that the films of 1980, 1968, and so forth are a product of the time of whatever's going on at that time?
Yeah, kind of. You can see a lot of the whole cell phone and general technology culture, lots of people texting, lots of people doing the whole Skype thing all over the place, the music, the way people dress, the way people act, the way people's ideals are and whatnot. So yeah, you can see that riddled through not just one type of genre of film, not just horror or sci-fi or drama. It's kind of every generation's kind of got its thing.
Do you see that there's a philosophical angle that goes along with film just as much today as it went to, as it did in the past, of talking to the social norms or the social fears of this time period?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting newer movies that do kind of speak a little bit more towards what's going on right now. Something like the movie Unfriended, where they tried to make a horror movie that revolved around Skype. Something like that makes sense because you have more people that are communicating through that versus, you know, than they would have 10 years ago. There's a lot more technology that is going into these kind of movies, whereas not so much years ago, because now we're so much more reliant on technology that it has to start making its way into movies. And it's giving a lot of people a hard time because the old, you know, they're trapped, you know, the car breaks down, they're trapped in the middle of nowhere. Just break out your cell phone and give somebody a call. They're trying to find ways around that. Oh, they got an accident and the phone broke, or, you know, they're really trying to get beyond just the, oh, we can't get a cell signal. Because now it's like, if you can't get a cell signal, especially in some of the locations where they are, it looks really dumb.
There is that, but I'm talking about something like, say something like Unfriended. I'm probably overanalyzing what is a really stupid movie, but all of this takes place over Skype. All these people are separated. How technology has pulled them apart to the point where all of this is able to happen, where it couldn't if all these people were in the same room together. Do you think that that's an answer to the social norm of technology running amok? Or do you think there's more to it? For instance, like, arguably, Night of the Living Dead is one of the most social movies ever. You got to put yourself into the mindset of 1968. Martin Luther King had just been shot when the movie came out. So even when it was made, that hadn't happened yet. The hippies taking over, you had all this social change, and literally, and Romero admits this, the movie is about a new society swallowing the previous society, although in this case it's literal. Do you see what I'm talking about? How a movie like Night of the Living Dead is an absolute reflection of 1968?
It definitely shows. I mean, Romero is one of the people who is always trying to push that with his movies, where whatever's going on culturally at the time. I mean, Night of the Living Dead was dealt a good bit with racism, and then Dawn of the Dead dealt with commercialism, and Day of the Dead was militarization, and what was the other theme with Day
Loss
of the Dead?
Hope.
The Loss of Hope. You had Land of the Dead, which was all about, again, a resurgence of commercialization, but also the haves versus the have-nots.
And terrorism.
And terrorism. Mm-hmm. And then I'll kind of stop there because it gets a little crappy.
No, because to stick with Romero, even Diary of the Dead, it didn't quite work, but he was trying to talk about how what you see becomes the truth.
Yeah.
That these people are watching the news and they see the edited footage of the initial zombie attack, and people buy that because it's on TV. And then when they see the unedited, and then even with the movie they're shooting within the movie, mm-hmm. they have to edit it. And she even talks on the narration about how she added music and all that to make it more effective. That mm-hmm. Diary is all about, just because you see it, you tend to believe it, but that doesn't make it true. I don't think the movie succeeded in that, but that's what he was trying to do with Diary.
Yeah, it was a good effort, and I could see where he was going with it for sure. And I agree with the Night of the Living Dead definitely being a reflection of that culture. Same with that Unfriended movie. I mean, it's a very big Skype and internet culture, and that's something that's been rising and getting bigger and bigger. A lot of people are, you know, making really close friendships with people all across the world. I mean, the fact that we're doing this podcast is a testament to that. So I think it's definitely a reflection on the culture. I don't know if the movie's good or not. I haven't seen it yet, but it's an example that each generation has movies that reflect on what's actually going on.
You have something like moving from Night of the Living Dead into the 70s. The 70s were arguably a more turbulent time than the 60s, even when you take the actual politics out of it. Movies becoming cynical and mean in the 70s that you didn't prior to that. Because in the 1970s, what was really happening was very cynical and mean. And so the movies had to reflect that. America was becoming a more violent place. Murder statistics and violence statistics were rising, which they would peak in the 1980s. The 1980s in film is arguably the most violent era of film. These things cannot be pulled apart. What is happening in society has to reflect what is happening in the movies. For instance, after 9/11, it was probably 5 or 6 years before we saw an American studio-made film that would even suggest the military was corrupt or wrong about something, because American patriotism was at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. No one like 20th Century Fox or Paramount was going to dare put out a movie about like a corrupt sergeant or something. You were not going to be able to put out a movie like Full Metal Jacket or Platoon after 9/11.
Well, 70s, definitely. I mean, that was the rise of the vigilante film, I think, is proof enough of that. Like you had characters popping up like Paul Kersey or Travis Bickle. So you could definitely see just through those types of films, through violent vigilante films, action against crime, and the cops are unable to stop it because it's so rampant. And then throughout the 80s, you had a big bravado of what being an all-American is all about. And you had characters like, you know, Rambo and Schwarzenegger taking the stage, and the big guns and the big muscles, and there's lots of violence. And it was very a time where it was a very proud to be an American kind of time.
This time, and then, we get to win.
Yeah, like Rambo 2 is a fucking testament to that. And then, of course, yeah, the whole 9/11 thing, it was a bit of the opposite. They weren't allowed to show anything negative. It was almost It was a more, even more over the top version of it. But they were scared.
I think for in the post 9/11 couple of years, a lot of those movies bordered on propaganda. They were almost American military propaganda without meaning to be.
They made it makes like Rambo 2 look like a serious film. So yeah, it can show how what's going on really can determine the kind of entertainment that we're seeing, and that whole post 9/11 time, that was a very walking on eggshells period for movies and just living in general. I mean, that spilled over into Canada. There was a lot of racism toward Middle Eastern and like Muslim people and stuff like that. You had people looking at people in turbans and just being like, oh, he's probably a fucking terrorist. Like, it was a very just a bad negative time that was trying to be very proud and American chest beady, but didn't have the vibrant nature that the 80s had, where you could kind of believe it.
Do you see that, like, going back to the 70s, Peter brought up the vigilante films. Not even vigilante, but let's go back to 1971 with Dirty Harry. Hit such a chord with 1971 audiences, because this was the beginning of the era where crime is on the rise, police are figuratively being handcuffed by, you know, having to actually give Miranda warnings and actually have reasons to do things to criminals. Then you had movies like Death Wish at the peak of urban violence. You had Paul Kersey. He was speaking to all the people who felt like they didn't have an outlet, that society had let them down, that the law had let them down. Do you think that those 70s crime films really speak more to the 70s than almost any other subgenre?
Yeah, because they were, a lot of them were the everyman. I mean, Paul Kersey, he was just, he wasn't really this giant ass-kicking dude. He was just a small Jew, you know, who you know, love him, but you know, when you think badass vigilante, he kind of came across as more of just like the, you know, an everyman. He wasn't Arnold Schwarzenegger or something going out there and just beating the crap out of everybody.
He throws up the first time he shoots somebody in that movie.
Yeah, it's much more, it adds a layer of realism to it, that he's not this unstoppable wrecking machine. He's just a regular guy who's out to get revenge for all this shit that's happened to him.
Do you think that sort of wish fulfillment of, like, you know, oh, I got mugged, I wish I could be like Paul Kersey or something like that? Do you think that is sort of wish fulfillment on the audience's part?
Well, I mean, movies in general are always having an element of wish fulfillment. You know, you watch a movie because you're like, wow, that guy has superpowers. I wish I had superpowers. Or, wow, that guy is banging Natasha Henstridge. I wish I was banging Natasha Henstridge. You know, or this guy, you know, you got mugged and it's like, man, you want to see him take out the criminals. So I mean, movies are always going to be an element of escapism and wish fulfillment.
But then sometimes that wish fulfillment goes too far. For instance, in like 1984, when Bernard Goetz basically went all Paul Kersey on, they were definitely criminals, but he went way too far. That's why he was convicted. You have something like the Bernard Goetz case. Does it get to a point where movies are reflecting society, and then society starts reflecting the movies?
Yeah, I think that can happen. I didn't even know about that case, but I definitely believe it happening, and I can see it happening, because I think people by nature, when they see something that they think is cool or that they relate to or whatever, they mimic it to a degree. I mean, how huge gym culture was when Pumping Iron came out, when Arnold and Stallone and got bigger, and the Rocky movies and Terminator, Conan, you know, Rambo, all this stuff. You know, gym culture was booming in the 80s. Everybody wanted to be, or most guys at least wanted to be, you know, beefed up like Arnie or Sly. So I can definitely see that. People will, life will imitate art, so to speak.
The Bernard Goetz case, for those who might not be familiar, Bernard Goetz was a little unassuming man with glasses who was sick of being mugged on the New York subway all the time. So when three teenagers came up to him and threatened him with a screwdriver, he shot them. And what made it go too far was he chased one of them down through another car and then shot him in the spine to make sure his message of, I'm not going to take this anymore, went through. And that's where it moved from self-defense to vigilantism.
Mm-hmm.
And that really happened. And that's really, that's a Death Wish movie, isn't it?
Was that guy parodied in Predator 2? That's that totally is. Yeah, there's that little wormy glasses guy who's like, I know how to use this thing on the on the metro system or whatever. Holy shit, I never caught that. I always thought that was just kind of young. I am young. I'm a baby.
But then
That was 84.
Yeah, I was 9.
I remember
seeing the Bernard Goetz stuff on the news.
Though at least bringing it up, I was able to call back to Predator 2 and recognize that was a reference to it. So, I give myself points for that.
Well,
but Peter, you've got a good point with Predator 2. Look at now. This seems like a weird microcosm of action and sci-fi movies, but look at all of the there was like 7 or 8 action movies and sci-fi movies that all came out between 1989 and 1991 that had Rastafarian gangs as the villains. That might seem weird to people who weren't alive then, but that was really happening. The country of Jamaica had cleared out all of their prisons and sent most of those prisoners to America. So in real life, Jamaican gangs were starting to make their violent presence known in larger cities. So to have them as the go-to villain for a couple of years was an absolute reflection of 1990. And if you weren't there, it'll just seem weird that all these movies came out in succession. Why do they all have Rastafarian gangs as the villains? Because that was what was happening for real at the time.
Yeah, especially in L.A., lots of trouble with Colombian gangs, Rastafarian gangs, stuff like that. Like that really was, it's obviously a very over the top depiction in movies like Predator 2, but there was some really nasty gang war or drug related kind of stuff happening. So that totally was a reflection of the later 80s and earlier 90s.
Oh yeah, definitely. Cause I had a friend of mine that was Jamaican and he was like, he's like, everybody's afraid of me all the time now. It's all Steven Seagal's fault.
If you really think about it, Marked for Death is 90 minutes of Seagal killing anything in a dreadlock.
Yeah, yes. Pretty much. I'm surprised you didn't fight the fucking Predator.
Like, that is a reflection of what was going on at the time. Let's go back to the early slasher movies. The early slasher movies were speaking to a different part of American culture. There are two parts. I disagree with Siskel and Ebert completely. Siskel and Ebert said that the early, maybe, 80 to 83, all the slasher movies were women-hating films. They outright said, these bullshit movies are made for people who hate women and fear women, and these movies are all about making sure a woman feels unsafe in society so she'll get back to the kitchen and start being a woman. They're not completely off base in the fact that this was the beginning of the true wave of feminism. This is when women are becoming CEOs. Women are getting equal pay in the workplace. So to a degree, they're onto something, that women are breaking away from men. But I think the whole slasher films are made for people who hate and fear women, they're projecting there, I think.
Major projection. Because the thing is, it's one thing if they don't like a certain genre. Like, you could always tell when they were watching a movie and they would get to the review part, and it was something where they're like, another Freddy Krueger thing. And it's just they're projecting their own dislike on it, because the majority of the slasher films weren't anti-female. I mean, the whole final girl thing kind of comes out of that. It's if anything, it's more like female empowerment. It's the girl who ends up doing the thing that the guys can't do and takes out the killer. So it's just silly. And I like, as much as I can respect Siskel and Ebert for what they did as far as bringing reviews more to like a mainstream audience, I always was annoyed at their just bias, like right across the, I mean, you should, they should have been like, look, we don't like these kind of movies, but we have to review them anyway. So they kind of, you know, go into it a little bit and talk about, well, you know, this isn't really good for us, but it might be good for you or something. It just always seemed that they would say that something sucked. And it's like, well, no, it doesn't suck. It's just that it's something that you automatically don't like.
Well, I've never really been a fan of Siskel and Ebert, and that's one of the reasons why, because they absolutely just project. They don't like those kind of movies, and instead of just, as Cecil said, you know, we didn't really like it, but here's this, if you liked this, you might enjoy this. Like, that's, to me, what a review should be. But they were just projecting their anger on it and completely making shit up. Their anti-woman movie, yeah, my ass, like... Yeah, that's why there's like Final Girls. That's why the chick usually chops off the slasher's fucking head at the end. It's just, it's preposterous, if you ask me. That's just ridiculous. They're very pro women. These movies are clearly made by people who love women and wanted to see women in more lead roles. Like, the slasher genre is arguably one of the biggest, you know, leading ladies that are playing more action-based roles, that are playing usually the kind of stuff you'd see a dude as an action hero doing, but instead you see a chick doing it. And movies like, you know, all the Friday the 13th gave us that, Halloween, even Alien, which I do count as a horror movie. Sigourney Weaver totally became like a dominating female action survivor. But yeah, I don't agree with that at all. To me, the slasher genre in general, at least the way I see it, is kind of a broadened depiction of the whole campfire story thing. Like, it's you know, the whole Cropsey thing, the children that went missing, all the stories being told about him, you know, during at camp or kids hanging out and stuff. It's kind of, to me, that's what sort of slasher movies have always been, sort of a projection of, just like these stories that your friend would tell you or that you would hear at camp, of this, you know, the guy with the hook for a hand, or just like serial killers and dudes in masks killing people and stuff, and stories being passed on. That's what I see. I don't see it as any degradation toward any sex or gender or whatever. It's they're just scary stories where one of the, you know, the strong good characters end up defeating evil at the end. It's very simple, good versus evil stories.
I'm not trying to say slasher movie producers were stupid, but you know, a lot of them were much more simplistic in their, they were just doing this because it was a formula.
Yeah.
But there was a weird formula that came out of slasher movies that kind of worked into the new puritanical nature of the 1980s. And by puritanical, I mean, remember, this is when Ronald Reagan, against all odds, really, took the White House, and the whole wave of new conservatism was sweeping across the nation. Pornography is being banned and whatnot, and the slasher movies put out the tenet, you do drugs, you drink, you have sex, you're going to die. The virgin is the one who survives. You've got films like Videodrome that are all about the dangers of unprotected sex and what can happen when disease goes unchecked and whatnot. In a weird way, some of these movies ended up unintentionally reflecting their era.
A lot of the stuff, it's always going to be a reflection of the era. Now, there's some movies that come out where they have nothing to do with it, and people start to look for things that don't exist, like trying to find elements of Jesus within the Terminator movies. There are elements of things where, yeah, something like It Follows, where it's a sexually transmitted disease, and that was kind of the structure that they used for it. So because there still is, you know, the fear of STDs even in 2015. So it makes sense to have a movie like that come out now, and it's not reading anything into it. That's just, you know, that's just surface level stuff. It's like, okay, yeah. And then, I mean, of course, there's always going to be little deeper elements of things mixed in, but such as with I know you haven't seen it yet, but we with Green Inferno, where it was a nice jab at all the social justice warriors,
yes,
where it's kind of taking the piss out of that. Like, that's something that is going on right now that I think a lot of directors and whatnot, they don't really have the balls to kind of go after them because they don't feel like dealing with the backlash of it. So I think that's another reason why we were talking before the show, where you're saying that a lot of critics are attacking him. Well, you know who else is attacking him? A lot of people who were attacking the other week's episode of South Park with PC Bro.
Let's look at like the slasher movies. Unintentionally, they got the trope of Final Girl, right? But the Final Girl was always the virgin, the one who didn't smoke, the one who didn't cheat, the one who didn't do drugs, depending on whatever the minutiae of the story was. But she was the puritanical one. The sluts and the women who were stepping out and the guys who were jerks all ended up getting killed. And then that trope gets repeated again and again and again to the point where is it more of a reflection of society, or is that just a repeated trope because it's a trope at that point?
A lot of people have that mixed up with a lot of the cheaper knockoff slasher films, because if you actually look at Friday the 13th, Alice was not puritanical. She smoked weed. She was sleeping with the head counselor guy, and she survived to the end. It's another good one. Like most of the Nightmare on Elm Street lead chicks. Slumber Party Massacre. They're all getting high and drinking and partying, and they beat the killer at the end. So I think it was something that was either lost in translation, or the producers of those ones with the more puritanical plots were like, okay, yeah, we can use this as to ward off premarital sex, which I always found to be one of the most annoying parts in Jason X, because they're making fun of slutty characters. We love premarital sex and smoking dope, but yet almost every lead chick in the Friday the 13th films prior was a chick that smoked dope and, was having casual sex with either her dude guy, or boyfriend or whatever. So I don't really know at what point it became that whole puritanical thing, but I know that there have been producers and writers and directors and stuff that had this idea that that's what it should be. But I think people need to realize that a lot of the more well-known ones, the people who are like, oh, the Friday the 13th movies are just, it's the prissy girl that survives to the end and all the stuff they said in Scream about how, never having sex. It's like, that's an example of Halloween 1. When you look at like 70% of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and the other Halloween films and stuff, it couldn't be further from the puritanical thing, if you ask me.
I just watched, the movie that I'm doing this week is Neon Maniacs. And at the end of the movie, the lead girl, they're being chased in this school by all the neon maniacs. So what do? They lock themselves into a classroom and have sex. And she ends up living to the end. So, it wasn't a matter of her being a puritanical person or something. I just thought it was hilarious that it's like, oh, my God, there are these things that are going around. They're killing everybody. What should we do? Let's lock ourselves in a classroom and do it. It just really cracked me up. But, a lot of the are there a lot of movies with a final girl? Yes. Is every horror movie, put together by having the structure of the bad girl ends up dying and the good girl ends up living at the end? No, it just so happens that there's a lot of them. I wonder what would be the percentage. That's something I might look into. How many horror movies really do fall into the formula that Scream said that they did?
What about leaving horror aside? What about, I think science fiction actually speaks more to being a reflection of its time than anything else. Look at something like the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That is such a product of 50s era Red Scare that you can't ever watch that movie without thinking of that. Even if you weren't there. I wasn't alive in the 1950s. That reeks of Red Scare. And then you go to the remake slash kind of sequel in 1978, and it's all about urban decay, losing your personality, and about that whole sort of mealy-mouthed self-help nonsense of the 1970s. And then you go to the 1993 Abel Ferrara one, and you've got all about the militarization, how the military is literally, in this case, swallowing the civilian population around them. The Body Snatcher movies are a perfect example, each one being an exact replica of the era when it was made.
I think that the 70s one is my personal favorite of the bunch. It's one of the best movies. It's something that like people who are thinking about remaking movies, they really need to go back and watch that one and see how it's done. It's like, okay, they took the concept of the one, the original, but they made their own movie, and they made an incredible movie because they had really good effects. They had a great cast. They put a lot of emphasis into it. It wasn't just, hey, this was popular, let's make this movie again. Yeah, they all kind of had their own, more so the first three. The one that came out a few years ago with Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman was just a shameless remake where it was like they didn't have any ideas of their own. It was just like, all right, well, let's just do what they did before, only with a bigger budget and lots of CGI.
But to be fair, in keeping with tonight's topic, as bad as Invasion was, it did reflect 2005. It was much more technology based than all of the others. It was more of a scientific, although stupid pseudoscience, but a pseudoscientific look at the whole phenomena. So, and it also reflected that post 9/11 malaise of the government is right, although in that case they weren't. That one still falls in line of being a product of 2005.
I think it's really cool that each one has that element of which generation it's from. And I think both the 1970s one and the 90s Abel Ferrara one, they're both solid. Each are solid depictions of the original. I think they all do a really great job. Though the one thing I would have liked is if Leonard Nimoy had a goatee.
But, I mean, you also have movies that owe to... That owe to either the optimism or pessimism of a time. Look at Metropolis, 1926. You've got the buildup of World War I coming. You've got the fear of technology. And it's kind of funny to think of the 1920s as people being afraid of technology, but they were. You read scientific journals at the time, and they were afraid of technology. They thought hell and some of the stuff in Metropolis really was kind of our future. And at the same way, look at the 1980s, cyberpunk. Cyberpunk was all about the early internet and computers becoming so integrated into our society, which they were at the time. You can't look at anything, even modern cyberpunk owes itself to the 1980s. In a way, that one kind of betrays the whole era thing, because even 2000 cyberpunk really rings of the 1980s.
Well, what I find interesting about a lot of those movies, and it's kind of the opposite, because they don't reflect its current culture so much, but they end up maybe possibly inadvertently predicting things. RoboCop absolutely predicted a giant fall in the economy, corporations taking over. Terminator predicted the boom in the internet, that this thing would be integrated into everything, hooked into everything, running everything, have the technology that the government was using for NORAD on your little phone. So it's kind of cool that 80s sci-fi was not so much a reflection. I mean, obviously, Terminator is a very 80s movie. Blade Runner is very 80s. RoboCop has definitely that tinge of 80s with the synthy twinkles in the score and the neon lighting and whatnot. But it ended up being more of a reflection of culture now than it was back then, because a lot of kind of what the movies would say would happen ended up actually happening. So I think it's an interesting reversal.
Well, but then you also have, like, you know, the stuff of the 1980s, when you get to like the Cold War stuff, that is such a product of the 1980s, it becomes almost laughable. Like Top Gun. I'm not going to go into the whole, oh, it's all gay, blah, blah. I'm talking about the jingoistic, super patriotic Cold War nature of a movie like that. That could only have come out of the 1980s zeitgeist, couldn't it have? The same way that the X-Files could only have come out of the early 90s distrust of the government and the burgeoning technology of the internet and conspiracy theories being taken more seriously. You have to tap into the zeitgeist of the era.
Yeah, that's why I'm a little kind of iffy on the return of the X-Files. Like, as much as I want to see it, it's not going to have as much impact as it did back then. It's going to be more of a nostalgia trip. It's going to be, oh, I remember this. This is awesome. Because they've already said that they're kind of doing sequels to some more famous episodes. I think that the majority of that stuff is really just kind of captured in time. Like, it's not going to feel the same. It's not going to make as much sense because things are different now. Like you said, with the government conspiracies, the fear of the government. Now it's like when you come out, you know, everybody's got a conspiracy about everything. Whereas back then it was a little bit more of a finite thing, and you had a lot of people that really believed in certain aspects of conspiracies, and they would go on the early versions of the internet, and they would go into little AOL chat rooms and talk about it and shit. And it was cool. But now it's like it's just not going to have as much of an impact.
The harp machine is controlling the weather with mind control.
Like, thermite like paint, a Navy SEAL.
But you also have, coming out of things like the Cold War and things like that, you also have how they captured an era as much as they were reflecting it. Like, nowadays, something as overtly jingoistic as Top Gun or Spies Like Us comes across. You look at Rambo First Blood Part 2, and we all make fun of it now, especially Rambo 3. At the time, people were like, yeah, Sly is telling it like it really is. And I think that's the same way you see all the modern movies like Zero Dark Thirty and all that, that people are going like, you know, in 10, 15 years, they're going to look at that and go, God, this was borderline propagandist. That's the same way something like Top Gun was. In the 1980s, there was a very genuine, very real fear that we could get into a nuclear exchange with Russia at any time. Mm-hmm. A movie like Miracle Mile could only have been made then, but at the same time has an odd relevance today, doesn't it?
Oh, Miracle Mile is amazing. Miracle Mile is still good. Because
I just watched it for the first time recently, and it's incredible.
Yeah, it's such a well done movie because you really don't know what's going to happen. You know,
the viewer don't know more than these characters on the street do.
Yeah, and it's one of those movies where I remember being in the video store and seeing the cover and then watching it and being like, why don't people know about this movie? This movie is amazing. Yeah, it absolutely fits in, kind of like War Games too. Where a movie like War Games wouldn't really go. I know they're trying desperately to remake it because they can do the whole.
They made that god awful sequel about terrorism on the end of a few years.
Yeah, the what was it? The something code. The Dead Code.
Oh, that thing was so bad.
I could see them trying to do something now, and it's just like it was more interesting back then because people didn't really know about the internet. So, you know, seeing this kid get on this government thing, it was like, holy crap, you know, this really intelligent kid could get onto a government thing. And now if they did it, it would be like, yeah, that's probably could happen. Like, it just wouldn't have the same impact that it did back then.
Also, the fact that when it comes to the atomic movies, and I mean the atomic scare movies like Miracle Mile, because that's really what that was. That was a super liberal viewpoint of if we don't disarm, this is what could happen. Mm-hmm. Those things also tended to fail at the box office also because of the time that they came out. People were already seeing all of this stuff on the news. They didn't want to go see it at the movies, too. That also speaks to the era and the zeitgeist of when a movie is made, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it does, absolutely. I mean, you can movies like Miracle Mile, movies like War Games were a reflection on that Cold War fear of people genuinely worried about, you know, bombs dropping. So you can see the cultural relevance, and you can see it's not something that would be quite not nearly as prevalent as today, but back then, like that was an everyday fear for people, and it totally makes sense.
I know, since I lived through this era, when I was 10 years old and Dreamscape came out, that's the president's nightmare in that. I had nightmares over that, not just because it's an incredibly creepy sequence, but because if you were alive in 1985, holy shit, that that really hit you.
That hit me kind of like The Day After Tomorrow did. Or no, not The Day After Tomorrow. The Day
After Tomorrow. The Day After Tomorrow? That was a terrible movie.
No. Just the, I'm sorry, I mixed it up. The Day After. That was the nuclear scare movie with Jason Robards.
That was a TV movie, no less.
It was a TV movie, no less. But when the bombs dropped and they showed people like evaporating, terrifying for a freaking kid.
When it comes to The Day After, that was supposed to be so terrifying. They even had a special after that aired. Right after it was a special called Counterpoint, where Ted Koppel and some of the biggest minds in America debated whether this movie is accurate or not, and they all said it's not accurate. Why? It's too optimistic of what would happen in a nuclear exchange. That actually is more chill. The news segment after is more chilling than the movie, which is fucking frightening. If you watch this when it first aired, and I've got this on tape, there are no commercials after the bombs drop. Not a single advertiser wanted to buy airtime on this movie after the bombs drop. So this whole move, the TV movie, was front-loaded with commercials. That also says something about the era it came out, doesn't it?
Big time.
Yeah.
So
lots of definitely lots of propaganda and whatnot.
Is there a difference between a propaganda film and a scare film, though? The Day After is meant to scare you, whereas Top Gun is meant to make you go, rah, rah, fuck yeah, America.
There's definitely a difference. I think a scare film, I think, is a little more honest, because it's trying to in some way show you the consequences of a culture going the wrong way and the threats of war. And whereas you've got propaganda films where I mean, Rambo 2 is very propaganda riddled, but I think it did try to have heart and a message and it did have the balls to kind of call out the government for lying about troops that are missing and things like that. So that was kind of cool about that one, even though it still was very much rah-rah, you know, barrel-chested Stallone mowing down Viet Cong and Russians.
Rambo, you not expendable.
Yeah, it's like when you get invited to a party and you don't show up, it doesn't really matter.
I always liked when he took the one girl died and he took her necklace and he tied, like, it was loose around her neck and he ties it around it and it just barely fits around that tree trunk of a neck of his.
We'll end the night talking about Vietnam. Now, you have movies like that, which is arguably a Nam movie, but then you know, you have Platoon and whatnot. There's a weird thing. Since I was alive in the post-Vietnam era, and Vietnam being the war nobody wanted, where the soldiers were spit on, they didn't have jobs coming back, you know, they had no health care, they had no mental care. It's not like today. You got to remember, it took almost 5 years after Vietnam ended before the first Vietnam movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas, look at, like, World War II. They were making World War II movies right after World War II. Gulf War? Making Gulf War movies right after. Yeah. Iraq War? Iraq War movies right after. But Nam, nobody wanted to touch a Vietnam movie because of the culture in America at the time. America almost collectively wanted to forget Vietnam happened.
Yeah.
Like, it was a bad mistake. We want to put it behind us and move forward. And movies, again, reflected that. The fact that there were no Nam movies for about 5 years really says something. And then the first ones that did come out were exploitation films like The Exterminator. You didn't get Platoon in that for like a good decade. It was the exploitation movies that said, we really need to have this Vietnam conversation. We can't put it off any longer.
It's interesting because now whenever anything happens, it's like producers are tripping over their own dicks to try to get the movie version out. I'm sure that whenever there's some national or worldwide event, there's always somebody who's like making phone calls while it's happening you know, we need to make this happen. We need to, you know, it just seems that we don't have that respect or that time really to kind of get beyond something where they're just in such a hurry to be like, you know, we have to have this movie out. A lot of them, I don't remember people clamoring for certain types of movies.
What are your final thoughts on how movies reflect society and the society and the time that they come out? At the same time, society reflects the movies.
Well, I think the best example that I can come up with, just, and we were talking about it just a few minutes ago, was the whole Vietnam War thing. Vietnam War movies that ended up taking so long to come out. And then you compare, you know, the World War II movies that came out almost right away, the Gulf War movies that came out right away, the war in the Middle East movies that are still coming out, like movies like American Sniper, and everybody's got to tell the story of the heroic Chris Kyle and all this shit. And it's because of, 9/11 happening. So now, everybody hates those guys. So you got to go out and be a total patriot and kick the Haji's asses or whatever. Whereas with Vietnam, it was an unpopular war. America wasn't proud of it. And that's why
And we lost.
So it's like it was exploitation directors that had the balls to do it first. Movies like Rolling Thunder, movies like Exterminator. First Blood, in a way, almost has that. Like, it doesn't feel like a Hollywood film. It's very anti-law. It's very anti-establishment. And those are a lot of the kinds of Vietnam movies that came out. Look at Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, Platoon. They're not your typical kind of war movie. They look at it from both sides. They look at it from Vietnam's perspective as well as America's perspective, the effect that it had on the soldiers from both sides. And I think that's the big difference, is the fact that it wasn't in that time, in that cultural period, nobody was happy with Vietnam. The soldiers were being spit on. So the movies that came out were very rebellious, Vietnam veteran vigilante movies and stuff like that. And those were very cool and very different. And they added, they shook things up a bit, which I think was great. And people standing up for these soldiers that were spit on. Whereas you have the popular war movies, you have Patton, you have all these, American Sniper being the biggest example of just full on bullshit propaganda. That's the difference. It's whatever is super popular, that's going to be given like the big heroic credit.
Entertainment medium has always been kind of a mirror. It's showing us back, warts and all, what's going on in the world. Now, sometimes they'll glorify things that don't need to be glorified. Sometimes they'll showcase the ugly underbelly of stuff that people would rather not talk about. But there's always going to be some element of what's going on in the world, reflected back at us. So I think that it's interesting when you get people that have the guts to go out there and do the unpopular thing, to show, all right, well, here's, Vietnam vets that, they're not all coming back right. Here's, mentally unstable people that are, not saying the Vietnam vet, but moving to another thing. Like with Reagan in the 80s, where he let a lot of people out of the insane asylums. And so you had a lot of crazy people walking around the streets. So there was a lot of movies about just insane people going around murdering people because, there were a lot of crazy people around the late 80s. And I think that it's interesting when we look at that, because you go back and you look at entertainment and it is a reflection of what's going on. Now, granted, not so much exactly like you have science fiction that, of course, we're not flying out into, other planets and all this stuff. Well, we're going to Mars now, but I'm talking like going out of our solar system. But maybe there's aspects in there like with.
Are you trying to argue that Supernova is not a reflection of the late 90s? Society has always reflected film the same as film has always reflected society. Now, you're always going to get a twisted reflection because there are multiple sides to any societal issue. So that's why you can have a pro-war movie come out at the same time as an anti-war movie all about the same war. So society is absolutely reflected in the movies. The movies would not be able to work if they were not also reflecting the society that they were made in. So you have to look at that on a deeper level. Like a slasher movie from the 80s isn't just a slasher movie. It's a response to Reagan and the conservatives taking over the country. You can't deny that. It might not be an overt reaction, but you can see it. Peter, where can people find you reflecting neither film nor society?
You can find me hopefully reflecting film and society or something in the form of a new video, hopefully soon, on YouTube, the Cinemasochist, Cinematica, on Twitter at Cinematica, Facebook, the Cinemasochist, and on 1201beyond.com as well.
Cecil, where can people find you being wrong about film constantly?
You won't find me because I'm a Navy SEAL, a fighter.
And a fighter.
You can find me over at escapistmagazine.com, goodbadflix.com, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, as all the usual stuff that I always trail off at the end.
You can find me at 1201beyond.com. You can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com, where I will end up reflecting neither society nor film, or maybe both.
Because you've seen things that'll blow our minds.
begins. Trouble begins to bite when you come around now.
Extreme.
Radio Drone is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.